This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, August 2nd. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we will be hearing from Ethan Genter and Ray Ewing of the Vineyard Gazette. We'll check in with CAI's Eve Zuckoff and Jeanette Barnes. We'll speak with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle and Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. We'll hear from Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror and CAI's Gilda Geist. And we'll speak with Sam Houghton at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Debris from the broken Vineyard wind turbine blade has made it to Martha's Vineyard, appearing on island beaches. We're going to hear about that in a moment, but first a little backstory for folks just catching up. Fiberglass and styrofoam debris have been washing up on Nantucket since the incident on July 13th when a turbine about 15 miles south of the island broke during testing. A big section of the blade, which was more than 300 feet long when intact, dropped off in the following week. Joining us now with the latest on this story, we have Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve.
And also with us, we have staff photographer for the Vineyard Gazette, Ray Ewing. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Steve. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Ethan, let's start with you and the latest from the island. We're almost 3 weeks out from this initial incident when the blade first gave way, and this week was the first time that the Vineyard has seen debris. What changed, and what has the island seen so far?
Yeah, so we started seeing on Wednesday, we started seeing some styrofoam debris wash up in Eggertown down at Norton Point and South Beach, which are the kind of our soft shore beaches over here. And we were kind of lucky. We hadn't seen anything in the initial weeks. We didn't, like Nantucket has. The change is believed to be kind of a change in the wind and the current, which then, instead of kind of shifting over more to the east, came our way. Fortunately, we haven't seen any of the large fiberglass pieces, those kind of big green chunks that people have seen out on the water and over on Nantucket, but we are starting to see, I think they call them popcorn size. We have seen some larger than that too. Pieces of styrofoam starting to wash up at various spots around the Vineyard.
And what has been the Vineyard wind response? They're tasked with cleaning this up. Are they there on the island sweeping the beaches?
Yeah. We had seen some folks down at Norton Point and South Beach. They were out picking it up. We've got some reports of small bits over on Chappaquiddick at Waysquee. We've heard also maybe in Aquinna. Chilmark seems to be unscathed at the moment. GE, Renova, Vineyard Wind have been out here and have been picking it up.
So I should explain that the wind farm is owned by Vineyard Wind, which is putting this together, a 62-turbine wind farm about 14, 15 miles south of the islands. But the blade and the turbine itself and the blade are made and installed by GE Vernova, and they've been kind of leading the charge and trying to figure out what happened and the cleanup. Do we know, Ethan, what's the latest at the site of the turbine right now? What is the state of the broken turbine and turbine blade?
Yeah, so recently they've been rotating the blade slightly, like 10, 12 degrees, to try and see if there's debris, if there's any kind of loose pieces still. BESSI, the federal agency that oversees offshore wind, doesn't want people kind of going out there to, you know, get pieces off or detach this blade, what's remaining, if there's still a chance of pieces falling down. So they're trying to get more pieces off. More pieces fell off, I believe, on Monday. Some sunk to the ocean floor. That's also where some of this styrofoam is expected to have come from. There's still pieces, large pieces, sunk on the bottom of the ocean floor out there. We're still kind of in a holding pattern, figuring out how they're going to retrieve these things.
Ray, I want to ask you, you have an amazing photo essay on the website. You were able to get out to the wind farm earlier this week and photograph this. Can you just tell us about this trip?
Sure. Thanks, Steve. We felt it was important. We'd been trying for a little while to get out there in person to really see and get our own photographs. It's a pretty disorienting experience once you get out there amongst the turbines themselves. They're over 800 feet tall. The blades are, like you said, over 300 feet long. And so until you're really amongst them, it's hard to really illustrate or explain the scale to someone who hasn't been out there.
Had you been out there before, or was this your first time?
So we had been taken on a stakeholders tour before any of the turbines were completed by Vineyard Wind and Avangrid, but we had not been out there since the completion of the turbine, and obviously this incident with the broken blade made it that much more urgent for us to get out there in person.
Okay, tell us about what you saw there. Some of the images that you posted to the website here, there's the broken blade itself, kind of a stump still on the hub, and then a piece hanging down. Were you able to kind of really circle this thing and take a look at what had happened?
Yeah, it's a pretty alarming, as you can see in those photographs. There is a 500-meter buffer safety zone once you get out around the actual turbine itself. There are some vessels kind of enforcing or running security on that safety buffer zone. But it's a 300-foot-long piece of fiberglass and foam and other materials kind of just precariously dangling from the turbine itself. So we were able to kind of safely go around in a circle and get it from all angles and see all the damage. But you can see the damage from a few miles off, and it is pretty alarming looking.
What kind of other activity did you see out there? Company ships? I know they're no longer generating electricity at this moment. Everything's shut down, but they
Right.
are laying cables. And do you see indications of the company out there working on this broken turbine? I think a lot of people have questions about why it's 3 weeks after the accident, this piece is still hanging there, shedding debris. Does it look like there's activity
Right.
there?
I did not see any activity on the broken turbine other than, again, that kind of enforced buffer zone with a couple of vessels out there. There were some other minimal activity, I would say, some other vessels, but in other areas of the wind turbine, wind farm, possibly, like you said, laying cable. But yeah, no cleanup crew, no direct work happening on the broken turbine, as we said. We did, by the way, find a smallish section of fiberglass on our steam out there from Edgartown.
About how long does it take by boat to get out there?
Well, it's the closest turbine is about 15 miles off of Waisqui Point, so it's about 2 to 2.5 hour steam in the vessel we were in. But again, these turbines are 1 nautical mile apart, so the broken turbine is 6 or 7 turbines deep into the wind farm. So, we're probably about 25 miles out. So maybe 3 hours total.
Ethan, let me bring you back in here. U.S. Congressman Bill Keating, who represents the region, weighed in on this recently, calling for a better protocol for notification. Tell us a little bit about what he's pointing at with this.
Yeah, I think a lot of the concern had been, especially over on Nantucket, was that Nantucket wasn't told about this until 2 days after it happened. This happened on a Saturday, and Nantucket learned about it on a Monday afternoon. And so our congressman, Rep. Keating, has written to different folks and our tribal chair, Cheryl Andrews Maltese, as well, saying, we really need to establish a better protocol for when do we tell people about these things. If currents were slightly different and this moved faster, would we have known before it had started showing up? So I think that's the thing. They're saying, we really need to get a better handle on this. And this is a brand new industry in the U.S. So is everything built out probably the way it should be? In Keating's eyes, no.
As I mentioned, they are not generating electricity right now. Kind of that wind farm has been shut down until they figure out what happened. But the company is still working out there. Can you tell us about what we know about the activity that's going on?
Sure. Yeah. On Saturday, the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, which is again that federal agency that oversees offshore wind, they gave Vineyard Wind the go-ahead to continue cable laying, which is kind of building cables that will connect the turbines to the main cables that then go to the mainland with the power. So all of these are kind of built in clusters of five, I believe, and then they all kind of come together at one point cable-wise, and then they all eventually lead into there's main cables that go to then to the mainland. So they are still allowed to do that. This has raised some questions, how rigorous is the investigation going to be? Why are we allowing dedication of boats to that if the cleanup still isn't even done yet? This was a very contentious point raised at a Nantucket Select Board a week or so ago. So that's kind of the lay of the land out there as we know it.
That is Ethan Genter and Ray Ewing of the Vineyard Gazette. You can head over to the Vineyard Gazette website to read all about it and see the photographs. Ray and Ethan, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
A little later in the program, we will be updating the Nantucket impacts of the turbine incident. But now, Massachusetts firefighters may have finally won a years-long fight to rid their gear of cancer-causing chemicals. CAI's Eve Zuckoff has the story and joins us. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
This is a story that starts in the Massachusetts State House. Tell us what happened this week.
Sure. So this week, the House and Senate both passed this bill that firefighters have been pushing for a really long while now. Happened in the early morning hours of Thursday. There were some doubts about whether it could happen, but it effectively bans manufacturers from selling firefighting gear that's made with almost any PFAS starting in 2027, January 1st, 2027. And before that, beginning in 2025, the bill requires a manufacturer of firefighting turnout gear to provide notice if its firefighter equipment includes these cancer-causing PFAS chemicals. And now it's awaiting Governor Mara Healey's signature. Nothing is expected to change or get slashed. People are feeling pretty confident she will sign this bill, but we will see.
Okay, for people scratching their head right now and saying, why is there PFAS chemicals, these cancer-causing chemicals, in firefighting gear, and why is this so important that firefighters have had to create a bill around this to protect themselves? What's going on?
Yeah, okay, I'll take on the first bit to begin. So a Massachusetts-based group that guides national gear standards virtually requires the use of PFAS chemicals to be in gear so that it passes this one very particular UV light test that firefighters have been saying for years is an unnecessary test. It's based on a graduate student's work from a really long time ago, and there's a lawsuit around this, and it's quite messy. Firefighters also accuse this gear standards body of kind of being in the pocket of industry. It's a huge fight. We've been reporting on that. We've got some stories about that on our website. It's created this situation where firefighting gear is pretty much loaded with PFAS chemicals, and there are a lot of health effects.
And why was it in the gear then in the first place?
Yeah. It was just to pass this standard. But the result is that firefighters have a 9% higher chance of being diagnosed with cancer than the general U.S. population, 14% higher chance of dying of those cancers. That's according to research by the CDC. I think there's a feeling that those numbers are actually inflated, too, because when I, I'm talking to firefighters.
Are inflated or these numbers?
I'm sorry, that the real numbers are actually higher.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Because when I'm talking to firefighters, I mean, they're able to rattle off a dozen, people in their 30s and 40s that are battling cancers.
We know that firefighters are exposed to a lot of chemicals already in their line of work. This bill is not a law yet. Where is it in the process?
Yeah, still just kind of some little things, is my understanding, are being ironed out between the House and the Senate. It's just some tiny kind of word changes, but it's on its way to Governor Healey's desk. And again, as you said, there's this link between the really high levels of PFAS chemicals in firefighting gear and a range of cancers. And these are the forever chemicals that we talk about on air pretty regularly. I mean, we're all exposed, but few professions are as at risk as firefighters. And they're already facing so many other job-based hazards that the feeling is they really want this stuff out of their gear. This puts Massachusetts as pretty much the best state in the nation to be a firefighter as far as PFAS in gear goes.
Let's switch it up and talk about the hurricane preparedness stories that you have been bringing us over the last few weeks. Tell us about your story this week.
Sure. So this week, I looked at how a major hurricane could upend our local economy. And what I found is that after a major hurricane, you can see a major shakeup of the demographic of a community, which is not exactly what I was expecting, because rising flood insurance premiums make it so that people can be priced out of their homes. And this is really worrisome, not just for the people who get displaced, but for our whole community. I talked with the head of our Chamber of Commerce, Paul Nidzwicki, and he said the Cape may look similar in 20 or 25 years from now, but we may not have the Cape anymore. I mean, there's a risk that we could just not have a viable middle class, and that results in a real risk to the entire local workforce and labor supply, which is only going to increase cost. So it's kind of a self-feeding cycle that he worries about and that a major storm could really ignite.
We know that we're in a season right now in which NOAA, the national body that looks at this, has said that we could see more storms and more powerful storms than we've seen before. Could the Cape and Islands get hit hard enough that you can imagine this place actually becoming less desirable?
Well, we can look at places like the Jersey Shore, right, which has a really similar real estate market to the Cape and Islands. In 2012, after Hurricane Sandy hit, researchers found that the houses that were affected by Sandy that suffered major damage, for 3 years, they were worth less than neighboring houses. But by year four, the market had just forgotten, and they were worth just as much or more than neighboring houses. So then people, again, like Paul Nidzwicki, think, okay, so that's good news for local homeowners, for people who have, you know, real investments in this place. But we could need some kind of marketing campaign after a major storm or a series of them that promotes our resilience. But it probably wouldn't take a lot, because the Cape and Islands aren't just a place that people visit. This is a place that people really, really care about.
All right. Briefly, this was the final installment of your three-part series on the worst-case scenario hurricane. Do you have any takeaways for us?
Well, over the last 3 weeks, you know, we've been talking about why climate change makes a major storm increasingly likely to reach our state, where our infrastructure is at risk, and how a major storm could permanently change our unique real estate market and economy. But, you know, the truth of it is that even though we can learn from the storms of the recent and more distant past, like, climate change is just making so many things unknowable. I think that's what's really stuck out to me. And that's not just what we rebuild and how, but like, who will be here? Just, I don't know, just the fabric of this place. It expanded my imagination about what Cape Cod and the islands could be, thinking about the power of climate change.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. You can see all her reporting on this at our website. It's under the title The Big One. Eve, thanks.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak to CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. If you were in New Bedford last night, you may have heard Music in the Air. It was the first night of the Madeiran Feast. The event is a Portuguese festival with Catholic origins. It's formally known as the Feast of the Blessed Sacrament, and it's billed as the largest Portuguese feast in the world. But it's in the news today not for its size, but because women are now members of the feast committee after more than a century, and they did it by warning the men they would sue. CAI's Jeanette Barnes reported on this and joins us now. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
So first, tell us a little bit about why the feast is so important to the people involved in it. It's a lot of work to produce it.
Yes, that's right. It is. But it's a labor of love. You know, it's a way that people connect to their Portuguese heritage and their island heritage from Madeira specifically. Many of them have grandparents or great grandparents who have been involved in the feast. And these families, these generations are working together, doing everything, the decorating, the food and everything else to make it happen. So, you know, people really feel connected to family and community through this. There are people who have moved across the country who come back just for this. And it has like both ancient and modern cultural things, right? It's got rock music on the stages, but it also has traditional fado singers, it has folk dancers, all of those kinds of things.
So, as I understand it, women have been doing a lot of work for the feast all along, but they weren't allowed to be on the planning committee.
That's right. So the Madeiran Club, which runs the feast, originally had a rule that you had to be a son of a Madeiran father to serve on this feast committee. And you have to serve on the committee first to become a full member of the club. They changed it in the 90s so you could be the son of a Madeiran mother, which brought more people into the club. But ironically, there's a two people told me this actually, and one was a woman visiting from Madeira for the feast. She told me that the village that inspired this feast has its own feast, and they have no such rule about women, and they have not for many years, if ever. But for some reason, they did have that here. The club here was founded in the ni early 1950s, actually after the feast started. And some of the men told me they feel like it was less about excluding women per se and more about what was pretty common for men and women at that time to have separate clubs and activities.
I know the club took a vote in October to allow women, and that vote failed. But then by April, things changed. What do we know about what happened? Tell us.
Yeah, so after the vote failed, a few women separately started talking to their friends about what to do. One of them started a Facebook page, and then, somehow they all kind of gathered, and by March there were an initial seven women who agreed to hire a lawyer. Their lawyer sent a letter to the club's attorney, telling them that they were prepared to file a lawsuit. So then subsequently in April there was another vote by the men of the club, and then that's when they got the votes they needed. They needed a 75% majority.
One of the things that I love most in your story is hearing from a grandmother and a granddaughter who are now serving on this committee together. Tell us about their story.
Yes, that is Maria Peixoto is the grandmother. She's 87, and everyone seems to know who she is because her father was one of the four men who founded the feast. And she now has three granddaughters serving on the committee as well. She's serving as well. I interviewed one of the granddaughters, Jenna Peixoto, and the grandmother, granddaughter, they both said they're finally getting their turn to do this thing that's been in their families for so long, and they're really just very, very happy to be doing it.
I want to ask you about you visited the feast grounds during the preparations for the feast. There was a lot of activity, it sounds like. Tell us what they do to prepare for this and what the scene was like when you were there.
Yes, it was a privilege to be there, honestly, because I've been hearing about this particular day for years when they hang the bayberry greens to decorate the parade route. People go out to Westport at like 5 or 6 a.m. to pick these bayberry branches. They fill an entire roll-off dumpster and then bring it back to the feast grounds to. And everyone gathers there. They decorate these metal arches. They kind of lash the branches to these arches to create almost like a garland effect that goes over the parade route. But it's a fun scene there. There was music, a little dancing, which you'll hear about in the piece, but just everybody working together was great.
If folks don't follow us on Instagram, you really should because there's some great video that you posted of this whole setting up of the feast, which is kind of a spectacle in itself. But the feast started last night. It runs through Sunday, right?
Yes, it runs through Sunday, and there are many things we didn't really touch on, but there's lots of Portuguese food there. There's four stages, and the parade is Sunday at 2 o'clock.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes, and you can see and listen to the story on our website, capeandislands.org. Jeanette, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
A plan to clear trees around the Chatham Airport has been approved. It's been a contentious issue, one we've talked about in the past. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us with the latest. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, it doesn't sound like any of the parties involved are too happy with the final outcome. Tell us, where has this landed?
So after about 8 months of hearings and other meetings, the Chatham Conservation Commission last week finally issued an order for the Airport Commission's plan. It's called the Vegetation Management Plan. It involves removing trees around in a buffer zone around a vernal pool at the end of one of the runway. The commission basically approved the plan, but with a very strict list of conditions on how that work was going to happen. There's been a lot of concern in the community that you know, there was going to be clear cutting, that many trees were going to be removed. And while we don't have a precise number of trees that will be taken down, the order requires that the airport commission, the contractor that they hire, measure every tree to make sure that the trees are the ones that need to come down, and that they document the trees so that there'll be an accurate number of how many trees are taken down, where they were located, and what their size was. The reason for that is that, you know, the reason for the whole plan is that some of these trees have grown up into the airspace that's considered protected space for landing and takeoff for flights into Chatham Airport.
So there are a number of concerns here. One of them being that this is a you know, an environment that's being changed, and that, you know, that there are creatures that live out there, that this is being altered. And then there's also the concern of neighbors, right? That they have some concern that the airport is really potentially expanding in its operations.
Well, that's been one of the contentions of some of the critics of the airport, and that was brought up actually at a Cape Cod Commission hearing. The commission was asked to review this plan as part of a previous development of regional impact approval. It was sort of a modification of that. And the airport commission's counter to that is that, you know, this work is being done for safety reasons at the basically the order of the state aeronautics commission and the federal aviation commission, because these trees and there are others outside of the commission's jurisdiction around the airport, and some on private property, that basically pose a safety threat. And they say that removing these trees will do nothing to change the use of the airport. This is the airport commission's assertion, because they feel that because the use of the airport is governed more by the length of the runway than by any other factors. Critics say that's not true, that by removing these trees and getting approval from the federal government for a new approach, sort of a straight-in approach, will make it easier for larger planes, these so-called turboprop planes, to land at the airport. Well, many of those are landing at the airport now, so the commission is saying, you know, this is not going to make any difference in who can land on the airport. It's not an expansion of the airport per se.
And the airport commission now is going to have to not replace these trees in the same place, but essentially fund tree replacement elsewhere within the town. Is that right?
That's right. The commission order, the Cape Cod, or the Conservation Commission order, requires that for each tree removed, the airport commission contributes $70 to a special tree replacement fund that the town has established. And that money will be used to plant trees, ideally on some town-owned property where trees are needed. The commission would like to see them planted in an area that could sort of grow into a woodland ecosystem, which is kind of what is now around that vernal pool that they feel should be replaced elsewhere in town. So the commission's agreed to that condition. It's always possible that these orders could be appealed. At this point, there hasn't been any appeals filed, but we're going to be watching to see if any of the critics of the airport feel that they have a case to appeal this decision.
It's Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Senior Point is the only skilled nursing facility on the Outer Cape. It provides senior living and residential rehabilitation. Since a private company bought it from a nonprofit in 2019, the quality of care at the facility has been documented to have gone into steep decline. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent joins us with this story. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Steve. Good morning. It's of course, it's Seashore Point.
Oh, I'm sorry. Seashore Point, yes.
Yeah.
And
yes,
let me
used to be called.
Yeah, go ahead.
For many years, it was Cape End Manor when the town ran it. Then it became Seashore Point in 2009, I believe.
Your reporter, Jack Styler, has done a lot of work here digging into public records. He pointed to this decline in patient care. In his latest article, he examines the finances at Seashore Point, and he finds a lot that suggests potential fraud in the way the company is being run. Is that right?
That's right, Steve. Jack Styler has done a lot of reporting on this, looking into documents and talking to people for the last couple of months. And based on his review of public records and review by a nursing home administration expert and a lawyer specializing in nursing home abuse and neglect cases, they found that while staffing levels at Seashore Point have been cut drastically, the new owners, who are Benjamin Berkowitz, David Berkowitz, and Joseph Maestel, have been paying themselves what appear to be hidden profits, possibly as much as $1.5 million a year, through companies they control but did not disclose in their federal and state filings.
And as your reporter, Jack Styler, has been looking at this, it turns out that this is the way they're operating this. These people own a number of different senior facilities as well, both together and independently. Is that right? And
That's true. So the company that officially runs Seashore Point is called Point Group Care, and it's officially called Advinia Care at Provincetown. Advinia Care actually runs 11 nursing homes in Massachusetts, including two in Brewster, Pleasant Bay, and The Woodlands. And those three private equity investors who I named themselves own large numbers of homes. Benjamin Berkowitz is an owner of 15 different homes, David Berkowitz, 66 nursing homes. And Joseph Maestel appears to be an owner of at least 105 homes under different names. This issue of private equity buying up nursing homes and running them as for-profits and extracting money while the quality of care declines is not just a problem here. It's a national disgrace, really, I would say.
Can you tell us a little bit about the process by which Jack Styler dug into the finances here? And he spoke with a couple of independent, experts in finance for these kinds of senior facilities who looked at the publicly available reporting here in order to come up with these findings. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So the experts that he consulted, who he found through national organizations that advocate for elder care and for improving nursing home management, they're Christopher Cherney, who's an expert in nursing home administration and often is an expert witness in cases. He's based in California. Ernest Tosh is a Texas-based lawyer who specializes in abuse and neglect cases, and they volunteered to review the Seashore Point filings, which are required by Medicaid and Medicare in order to get reimbursements. And so there are, you know, public documents that can be reviewed. There also are state investigation reports, because all of these homes have been subject to complaints, which are investigated by the Massachusetts Department of Health and Human Services. So, for example, investigators from the state found 11 deficiencies in their last inspection of Seashore Point, which has been fined for substandard care.
I want to ask you, what does the company at Seashore Point say, the company that holds this facility?
Well, they would not let us talk to the owners themselves, and they would not answer specific questions about, for example, why these massive payments what are called related parties, which are actually controlled by the owners but have different names, they wouldn't tell us what, you know, answer the question, why were these not reported on these federal and state reports? What they say is simply that they offer a high quality of care at their facilities and that they comply with all of the requirements of, you know, the state and federal government, which, you know, in a certain sense may be true. Mm-hmm. The part of the problem here is that the system for policing these nursing homes is really broken. And because they're owned by these private equity investors who don't really have to disclose all kinds of detailed information, it's hard to actually tell exactly where the money is going in certain cases.
It's a series of reporting that you can find at the Provincetown Independent. There's a lot here. It's worth looking at. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Stay with us. Hey, this is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Earlier in the program, we spoke about the impact Vineyard Wind's failed turbine blade is now having on Martha's Vineyard as the debris comes ashore there. But in the past almost 3 weeks, it's been Nantucket that has seen the brunt of this. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror joins us with an update. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
What's the latest on the island here? What's the debris coming ashore like now, and what are people saying?
Oh, there's very little debris coming ashore now, and what is very small pieces of foam. The town and the Vineyard Wind are calling it popcorn sized. Nothing like a week or so ago when large chunks of fiberglass and styrofoam were coming up on the beach. We've sort of shifted more into the discussion phase of what's going to happen next and what the town can potentially do to salvage some kind of some satisfaction out of this. They're re-examining the good neighbor agreement they have with Vineyard Wind, but we've learned a little bit this week that the so-called good neighbor agreement was never going to include language about the catastrophic failure of the turbines or the blades or even how the company would be held accountable for them, according to the attorneys who negotiated the deal for the town almost 4 years ago. The agreement was really designed to address and answer questions about the potential adverse visual impacts of the wind farm on Nantucket, which is a National Historic Landmark, and it wasn't intended to anticipate everything that could potentially happen down the road, said Greg Werkheiser of the law firm Cultural Heritage Partners, who's the town's special counsel for wind energy. He said Vineyard Wind would never have agreed to hold themselves liable for something that was purely hypothetical at the time. The project was years away from putting steel in the water when the agreement was signed. That, however, doesn't mean that the town is hamstrung in what can happen now. They're not obligated to sue, although it is potentially an option. Shore-related businesses that saw a loss of revenue due to the floating debris that washed ashore, like surf schools and charter fishermen, could be compensated by Vineyard Wind and GE Vernova, the company that manufactured the blade and has admitted that a structural flaw and a failure to inspect was the cause of the damage. Without the need for a suit, those two companies said they plan to set up a financial claim system, but nothing's been established yet. But going back to the good neighbor agreement, it doesn't. This blade failure does not qualify as a breach of that agreement because no parts of it address potential mechanical failures or environmental impacts.
There was some talk about trying to renegotiate this agreement.
They are. The select board is actively considering renegotiating the agreement. They've been meeting an executive session this week among themselves and with members of Vineyard Wind, but members have not said what exactly they want changed, added, or removed from the current contract.
Let me ask you about another story in the paper this week. Neighbors living near the airport are concerned about what they fear is a PFAS-related cancer cluster. What's going on here?
There are four members of the community who live within a stone's throw of the airport perimeter who have all been diagnosed with cancers associated with PFAS contamination. And while scientifically it can't really be determined exactly why these people have their cancer diagnosis, and legally lawyers would probably be hard-pressed to make an argument that direct PFAS exposure from living so close to the airport is the cause, These families believe that, seems pretty obvious to them, that these cancers were caused by the toxic firefighting foam that was used for decades at the airport within sight of their homes. Use of this foam was mandated by the FAA for decades until the connection to PFAS led federal officials to cancel the practice and go in a different direction. Since then, the town has appropriated about $15 million for PFAS-related mitigation efforts in the neighborhood. They have brought private municipal water out to these neighborhoods. They've been testing private wells in the area and paying for bottled water and filtration systems. So the town has actually done quite a lot, but the neighbors say, you know, this has been good. This was going on at the airport for decades, and it appears to be, you know, that's the worst case scenario, at least for some of the families now. They're starting to show up with cancer diagnoses.
That is Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, where you can find those stories. Josh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gosnold Behavioral Health, the longstanding Falmouth-based nonprofit treating substance use disorder and other mental health issues, is looking to move off Cape. CAI's Gilda Geist has this story and joins us now. Hi, Gilda.
Hi.
Gosnold itself has been providing services for more than 50 years. It's had its inpatient treatment center in Falmouth since the early 1980s. So this represents a significant change for a major provider of services in our region. So first, tell us about how you found out about this.
Yeah, so the Wareham Week had a story that came out on Monday about a proposal by Gosnold to open a new substance use treatment center in Wareham. That news came out of a Zoning Board of Appeals meeting. And at first, I wasn't sure whether this was going to be replacing the Falmouth location or if Gosnold was just opening up another location. But in that Zoning Board meeting, Gosnold's president and CEO, Richard Kukuru, was clear. Yes, we want to move our 96 beds out of our Falmouth Treatment Center and into a new center here in Wareham. And that's something that Kukuru later confirmed in a written statement.
Mm. And we should be clear here that Gosnold is only proposing to move some of its services to Wareham, right? They have extensive services on the Cape.
Yeah, so it's Gosnold's administrative offices and then also its inpatient services that are leaving the Cape. And when I say inpatient services, I'm referring to those 96 beds in Falmouth. Half of those are for medical detox and the other half are for short-term rehabilitation. So those are the ones that are leaving. And the reason, according to the CEO, is that the Falmouth facility is apparently outdated and struggles to keep up its staffing levels. But outpatient services will remain on Cape Cod. Those are things like counseling, group meetings, medication-assisted treatment. Gosnold has outpatient programs in Falmouth and in Hyannis.
Hmm. And the focal point of the meeting in Wareham was really this concern by neighbors about a facility opening there.
Yeah, so there was quite a bit of concern from neighbors who have already organized and hired an attorney. And then zoning board members as well made it clear that while they supported Gosnold's cause, they wanted to make sure they were putting their residents first. There were a lot of concerns about security, lots of questions about whether patients will be able to wander the grounds, whether there will be an increase in traffic, whether patients will be coming on and off site each day for services. And again, the CEO was clear that there will be no outpatient services at this location. All the services they offer will be contained within the building. Kukuru, the CEO, also pointed out that Wareham has been hit particularly hard by substance use disorder and addiction issues, especially when you look at the rest of the state. His point being that if people are so adamant about not encountering drug users in their community, this project would actually be to their benefit. He also said that his organization would hire security detail if it would help make neighbors more comfortable. He said that's not something they've ever had to do before, but they'd be open to it. But ultimately, Gosnold's lawyers maintain that because this project deals with helping people with mental illness, federal disability law will be in their favor. Gosnold had an attorney at that meeting who said he did not want to have to go to court over this, largely because he's supposed to retire soon. But if it comes to it, he believes they have a strong case.
And we will be hearing more on this story, I'm sure. CAI's Gilda Geist. Gilda, thank you.
Thank you.
Yesterday, President Biden announced an international prisoner swap that resulted in the release of, among others, Paul Whelan. Whelan has family on Martha's Vineyard. Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times has details for us and joins us now. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Whelan's sister has been vocal in calling for his release now for years and clear in saying that he was unjustly held. Start by telling us about Whelan and the work his sister has done on his behalf.
Yeah, we've kind of been following the story for a long time. I mean, I think what jumps out for me, I remember he was in this kind of labor camp, and He was actually attacked by a prisoner there. So his sister, really, Elizabeth Whalen, she's an Egerton artist, has been really pushing, you know, state, federal officials to really to bring him home. There's, I mean, I think there's a fear for his life, really. But right, a lot of advocating. Congressman Keating has been helpful in this for the family. But right, I think, you know, this is huge news, national news. I think it was the lead story for several, you know, big organizations. New York Times, I think, reported it was the largest prisoner exchange since the Cold War. And we are reporting that just last night, their plane stepped down in Maryland, and Paul Whalen was the first one off the plane. Mm. Kind of embraced the president, embraced Kamala Harris, and then saw his sister for the first time in 2,000 days, something like that.
He's been in Russia since 2018. I saw some of that footage from the landing. Is incredibly moving, yeah, to see them come off the plane, including Evan Gershkovich and some others. Yep. Elizabeth Whalen, who is from the Vineyard or has a place on the Vineyard there and has been so advocating for her brother, she was there, as you say. She was also standing next to the president yesterday when he made the initial announcement that this was going to happen.
Yeah, that was pretty neat. We had to confirm that it was her. It took us a little bit, but we have some folks in our newsroom that know her, and we were able to identify her. We talked with Keating too, who kind of confirmed that for us. But yeah, even for a moment, I mean, she was right next to him, and while he was at the podium, and he took a moment to kind of pause and shake her hand in the middle of that kind of that ceremony. And they also sang happy birthday to I believe it was Gershkovich's daughter, who had just had her birthday. It's one of those surreal experiences where you have a Vineyard story that gets to the president, and he makes a speech to the nation for a massive prisoner exchange.
And it is a story, as you say, that we have been reporting on for the Times has been reporting on, and CAI as well, about the effort to that Elizabeth Whalen had was really mounting to get people to write letters and to make sure that that Paul in imprisonment in Russia was not forgotten, really.
Yeah, and I think she's kind of saying that Paul has really made a community here on the island, that this is partly his home as well. And so I think that she's definitely part of that. And I think also it's really interesting, part of the family released this really long, statement when news came out that he was being released. And most of it was thanking all these public officials, you know, congressmen. But kind of near the end, they made kind of an interesting point that Whalen is actually, he doesn't have a home right now. He doesn't have a job. He's coming out of a really intense prison. We haven't heard how he's doing physically, but we can only imagine. And he's going to need, a lot of help. We have a link in our story, I believe, where the family, shows how you can help him. But it's interesting to think about, someone who's been in pretty intense labor camp for 2,000 days. You can't imagine. I think also, too, we'll be on the lookout as he does return. We haven't heard if he's going to come to the island, but certainly it's going to be a big welcome when he arrives here. But, yeah.
Yeah, and on your story on the website, on the Vineyard Times, underneath the comments, a lot of people from the island chiming in about, how pleased they are about this and what it must mean for the family, which kind of reinforces that sense of community there on the island around this story. It's Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Sam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
That is our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from Ethan Genter and Ray Ewing of the Vineyard Gazette. We spoke with CAI's Eve Zuckoff and Jeanette Barnes. We heard from Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle and Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We spoke with CAI's Gilda Geist. And, of course, Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times. A big thank you to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. We'll talk to you next week.